This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Welcome to our Friday Pitch-In, where we split the hour between a couple different topics and guests. Coming up, a conversation I had earlier this week with an Indianapolis-area executive chef who's had to deal with this massive coronavirus shakeup just 3 months into her new job, how she's handling it, and are takeout orders enough to keep things going. And later, the bigger economic picture with a Ball State economist, and we'll look specifically at why we're seeing what's called price gouging and why, in his view, that's not such a bad thing. If the rage is brewing in you now that I've said that, just stay with us and hear what he has to say. But first, we'll kick things off with, it's the way we always kick things off on Friday, with a look at the week's biggest stories across the state from our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's another one of those weeks, isn't it?
Yeah, that is a gross understatement.
One part of your job is to look at the numbers of all of this and to compile them and to stay on top of them. Mm-hmm. What do we know now?
Yeah, as of 11:59, 981 confirmed cases in the state.
11:59 this afternoon or last night?
Last night. Yeah. They update the numbers at 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. So the newest information we have from the Indiana State Department of Health is 981 confirmed cases, 24 deaths, and 6,939 tested. So just to compare to last week we'd only had, at this exact time, only 2 deaths and 79 confirmed cases, but we'd also only tested 554 people. Mm. So we have, just by orders of magnitude, increased the amount of testing, but that's also given us more confirmed cases and, unfortunately, more deaths.
How interesting. So I understand that the protocol for people getting tested is, you know, you've got to have certain symptoms. They're being stingy with tests, and understandably so, but we've done almost 7,000 tests and only 900 and almost 1,000 confirmed cases.
Yeah.
Is it allergies? Why are people being tested? Why are so many people being tested and so few coming back positive?
Yeah, so they're really focusing on folks who are part of the higher risk populations that are severely ill, or folks who are healthcare workers or first responders. And so that's kind of where that group is living right now.
Okay. So let's see. What do we know about the federal response?
Yeah.
With respect to Indiana.
Yeah. So the third federal stimulus package, which is the one to help individuals and small businesses, is going to the U.S. House after it passed the Senate unanimously yesterday, which is something that seems kind of impossible in our current climate. So currently the bill will rush financial assistance to Americans with direct deposit checks to households in the middle class or lower income levels. And it also extends unemployment insurance program for laid off workers. So originally it's 3 months of full pay. Now it's 4 months. And it also raises the maximum unemployment insurance benefit by $600 per week.
Goodness. Full pay for 4 months. And I've heard of, you know, furloughs happening all over, and in some cases, furlough is better than perhaps staying on at some places if it's being offered. It all depends on what the company is offering, of course. But
yeah. It's a kind of shaky situation, and there's a lot of funkiness for folks who are contractors, for folks who there's just a lot of funk going on right now that the state and federal level are both trying to figure out for folks.
And checks? When are we getting checks? Are we getting checks?
Yeah. So that's also a part of that bill. The number has been thrown around a lot. The last I heard was $1,200 to individuals, to households. It's $2,400 per adult and then $500 for each kid. So that is still the number that I've heard pitched around. The unfortunate thing about that bill is that it's an 800-page document, and that's not something you can speed read.
You didn't read it?
No.
We will be talking with Ball State economist Steve Horwitz about the federal response later in the show, and of course we'll talk about some of the price gouging we're seeing, or what what some call price gouging. He likes to call it emergency pricing. We'll find out why later in the show, of course. Mm-hmm. And what about the state response?
Yeah, so, you know, the thing that we've been talking about all week, it's that stay-at-home order. So, of course, it was originally announced on Monday, which seems impossible because that was a year ago.
yeah, in coronavirus time, certainly.
Yes. So a bunch of businesses are still deemed essential, including hardware stores, laundromats, and pet stores that have adoptions. So there's a whole swath of businesses that are considered essential that you wouldn't necessarily think of.
I certainly did not think of pet stores that had adoptions.
You got to keep the animals alive.
I suppose you do, don't
yeah.
you?
You can't just leave the Walmart fish, you know, to die like they usually do. So.
Oh, goodness. Unemployment. What is that looking like?
Yeah. So unemployment has obviously skyrocketed. There were 62,000 unemployment claims last week compared to 3,200 the week before. So that's an insane increase. Justin Hicks is the one who's been really following unemployment really closely. And in his story, he said there was a 10,000% increase in one county in the state.
I wonder how the unemployment offices are handling that, because they've been, as he reported, they've been understaffed because unemployment was so low up until this point. Mm-hmm. And now, do they have enough people to handle all of this, I wonder?
Yeah, he's taking a deeper dive into that right now. So we should have an answer for that in the next week or two.
I really look forward to hearing from him on that.
Yeah.
So what about enforcement of this? People are being asked to stay home, but I mean, are the police really getting involved in any way?
Yeah. So the Indiana State's police superintendent said, you know what, no one's going to be asked to show proof that their workplace is essential. Nobody's going to be asking you for papers. But it's still very wishy-washy, and the state police are working with county and local police in order to help enforce this. So if you feel like you've been unnecessarily targeted, he's asking folks to report that to the Indiana State Police. But otherwise, it's again, one of those things where it's a bit wishy-washy, right? Holcomb said that he wanted to go after folks who were flaunting going outside and doing stupid things. There was a man in Michigan that claimed that he had tested positive for COVID-19 and then ran around, like, touching surfaces in a Walmart. So he was actually quickly arrested because their governor had already declared a stay-at-home order, had already done all of these things, so that gave them the license to arrest him. I think that's kind of what they're targeting with this. But that being said, you know, things happen. Report it to the Indiana State Police if you feel you've been unnecessarily targeted.
Rightfully so. Don't go around and do that kind of stuff, for
yeah.
heaven's sake. The primary election's been pushed back. When
yes.
are we going to vote?
We're going to vote on June 2nd, which also means that the deadline for registration has also been pushed back, much to my great delight. but there's also a couple of other intangibles out there, right? So Indiana has one of the most stringent vote-by-mail requirements in the entire country. I think it's one of the six states that has quite as stringent vote-by-mail requirements. And this week, the Indiana Election Commission both said that, yes, Governor Holcomb and the Secretary of State, we're on board for pushing this back until June 2nd. But we're also going to open it up so that if we wanted to, we could have every Hoosier vote by mail in the state. So that's a huge step. And so Democrats are really excited about it because this is something that Democrats have wanted for a very long time. Republicans less excited about it, but still, this is a global pandemic. So, yeah, we're gonna do that.
Special circumstances, to be sure.
Precisely.
And we had a show. We did a show on Indiana Vote by Mail and the initiative to make Indiana like Oregon and Washington mm-hmm. and Utah and Colorado and a number of states that have sort of adopted this comprehensive vote by mail service. You can check that out on our podcast feed. And I believe next Friday we're going to hear from Bill Morrow, founder of the Indiana Citizen. And we're going to talk with him about exactly that and why he's in support of it as well. So stay with us for that.
Mm-hmm. There is one thing that I want to note on the vote by mail for Indiana. And it's that, you know, Secretary Lawson, Secretary of State Connie Lawson, mentioned that she had heard a lot of concerns about individual election boards being overwhelmed by vote by mail elections. Mm. So keeping that in mind with what decision you make, if you're healthy, if you're good, then maybe go vote early by in person. But vote by mail is absolutely an option on the table.
Hmm. And one of the things with vote by mail, not to get into the weeds, one of the important things, as I understand it, is keeping the voter registration purged and up to date.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, as it has been in Indiana, it's going to be a challenge, it seems like,
to
institute that as a comprehensive strategy. Okay. What about getting some supplies out? What's the National Guard doing right now?
Yeah, so the National Guard is very much operating as a distributor for supplies that the state is getting. So the Strategic National Stockpile had supplies delivered to the Indiana National Guard yesterday, which they distributed to hospitals all across the state with the help of the Indiana State Department of Health, Department of Transportation, and Indiana State Police to get those supplies out there. And moving forward, they're going to continue to act in that way, that they are going to be a collection site for supplies. And then they're going to help with the State Department of Health target exactly what hospitals need, what supplies, as more is coming in from the Department of Correction and from businesses and manufacturers across the state.
Mm. And they've been on active duty since Sunday night, if I remember correctly.
Something along those lines,
Something along those lines. And I wondered what they were going to be doing. And this seems like a perfectly good use of their time.
Mm-hmm.
We had a postponement this week that kind of broke my heart. And I'm sure it broke a few other people's hearts, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. The Indianapolis 500 has been moved to August. Sorry, Mr. Penske. It's going to be weird for me. I usually spend Memorial Day weekend with my grandparents, and I grew up on the west side. So on Memorial Day weekend, you're grilling outside and you hear the race cars because they're so loud. And that's going to be, if I get to see them at that point, depending on where we're at with COVID-19, that'll be very different for me.
It's going to be August, something else has been moved to July 4th, the Grand Prix.
Yes, the Grand Prix has been moved back to July 4th, and then Indianapolis 500 has been moved back to August 23rd.
Now, wasn't the Brickyard race? I can't remember what it's called right now. Wasn't it going to be the July 4th weekend? Has that been moved as well?
I don't know.
Oh, goodness. It's all just a jumble right now, isn't it? We are, of course, participating in the Indiana 2022 way. We're sending stuff out quite a bit, it seems like.
Yes, we are sending out things weekly. We're either asking you questions or providing you answers every single week. So we're covering COVID-19. We're also still going to focus on the election. We're also going to continue to answer your questions. And thanks to the folks who already have signed up. You can join by texting elections to 73224. And that will allow you to join our text group. And for folks who are curious about, you know, other things related to our stories, if you see any story that has a comment box in the middle, if you give us a question there and you leave your email address, we'll go and find the answer for you.
Elections to 73224.
Yeah.
Text it out. All right. Lauren Chapman is our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, she runs the kitchens at two of the biggest independently owned sports bars in Indianapolis, but business is very different these days. A view from inside the restaurant biz in these troubled times. Next, I'm Matt Pelser. We're back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. About 10% of Hoosiers, well over 300,000 of us, work in food service, according to the National Restaurant Association. Like a lot of people, including the governor, I've been ordering takeout as much as possible lately to support restaurants who've been ordered to shut their doors to customers. I've also been tipping well. This can't be easy for the restaurants or the workers. Am I buttering up my guest? Maybe a little. But I also want some real talk on how it's been going. Erica Oakley is executive chef for two of Indy's most popular sports bars, Kilroy's Downtown and Kilroy's Broad Ripple. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay, but how are you?
Times have changed here in the last few days, so it's definitely been a learning curve.
Are you at the restaurant now?
Yes, currently downtown.
And you're filling out some carryout orders, I imagine. Not much else to do.
You know, we're cleaning nooks and crannies, pulling equipment out, and just trying to make the best of our time. You know, bringing some people in to try to at least divvy the hours out as, you know, even as possible. And we've been doing some menu creations, you know, working with some new pizza ideas and wing sauces and things like that. So we're definitely trying to keep ourselves occupied and tied up so we don't, you know, watch the clock too much.
Are these things that you would normally be doing, or are you taking advantage of the extra time right now? How is this all fitting in?
A little bit of both. You know, during this time, I was definitely focusing on March Madness and a big event that we called Blarney Bash, is a big St. Patty's Day celebration. So I was just trying to understand more of the menu and the food and everything before we got crazy busy. But yeah, definitely taking advantage of the time I have now to start thinking, you know, when we get back up and running at full capacity, what menu items have we tried? Let's bring the staff together and do some menu tastings and, you know, get some processes and new procedures into place.
Yeah, you're a sports bar. March Madness, you had to have been anticipating being a lot busier right now. How many carryout orders have you been filling?
You know, it hasn't been absolutely terrible, but I mean, at least we're still being able to, you know, provide for the community who, you know, still are able to go out to work and, you know, they don't necessarily want to take their food that they bought from the store. It's like, oh, Kilroy's is still doing carryout. Let's go, you know, support local. So we're very thankful that people are still, you know, keeping us in the loop of restaurants that are still doing that and have that option.
Has it fluctuated at all since this started, or has it been consistent?
We've had really, really good days, and then we've had kind of mediocre days. It really just depends on the day. I mean, it's, you know, at this point in time, more restaurants are just completely closing down. Being downtown, I actually notice it a lot more because the state buildings are closed, you know, the salons and the nail places and, you know, all the independently owned just little nooks and crannies and little shops around town. Those are closed too. So I feel like as this kind of has continued to go on, we've seen a little bit less and less as the days go on, but we still are, we're getting a few orders here and there.
So I'm assuming staff is down. We'll get to more on that in a minute, but just from your perspective there at Kilroy's, I mean, are the to-go orders enough to keep things going for the time being?
That's definitely the question that we've kind of been bouncing back and forth with all of our managers. And, you know, we don't want to just not be open just because, you know, we don't have food, because we do have food. You want to make sure that we're trying to get use of everything that we have here before we completely close. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's one of those things, especially keeping labor down, trying to keep those to a minimum. You know, we're pretty much all the salaried workers are here now, just so we can at least still try to make ends meet and, you know, keeping the labor down to a minimum.
What about the rest of the business? If you're filling a few to-go orders, are you having to order more stock, or can you even get more stock?
So we've actually just created yesterday. We rolled it out today. We did a limited features menu of kind of going through the coolers and being like, okay, we've got these ingredients for salads. We've got these ingredients for wraps and pizzas. And, you know, we've got breadsticks rolled. Let's just kind of focus on the stuff that we have that is still fresh and still good. So we've definitely limited our menu so that we can kind of gear in on those products. We actually haven't had an order in for over a week now. We've gone to the store to get, you know, odds and ends of things to make everything meet in the middle, but we've pretty much just been going on off of what we already have in store.
Yeah. I mean, food goes bad after a while. Have you had to throw anything out?
Unfortunately, yeah. We did have a big clean out in the last 2 days. A lot we were able to get rid of and utilize both stores. We did a really big donation. One day we did to the Wheeler Men's Center, and then we also did another day to the Women and Children's of Wheeler as well. So not everything's going to waste. We're trying to do our best to not let anything go to waste. But I mean, that's definitely a perfect world.
Have you talked to any of your peers in the restaurant business that have maybe had it a little easier or even harder right now? What are other people saying?
I've heard mixed reviews. Some places are still doing really well just because, you know, they're known for their delivery and carry out systems. You know, as you know, you said earlier, we're a sports bar. People come to watch sports and drink beer and eat wings and breadsticks. So we're kind of on the opposite end of, because, you know, we've never really focused on that end of, you know, delivery or carry out. I mean, we have carry out orders, but we're not necessarily known for that. People want to come in and watch the games and hang out with their friends and family. And so I've heard mixed reviews. Some places are doing great. Some places are, you know, they're struggling. They have, you know, unfortunately laid off majority of their staff and are telling them, hey, please, you know, work with us. We'll do whatever we can. You know, you're not fired. Please don't think that, you know, once this all passes, we'll bring you on board again. But, you know, people are in the same spot as we are. They're just working their salaried managers and kind of rotating days, who's there and who's not.
All right, well, let's get to that part. As executive chef, have you had to lay people off?
They are on a standby layoff right now. But, you know, it's one of those things when you're out of work for however long, what's the time where you go look for another job? So I know I do have individuals who, you know, were worried about, are you firing me? And I'm, you know, that's definitely not the case at all. Just unfortunately with not having as much business as, you know, Kilroy's always has, I can't afford to bring individuals into work an 8 or a 10 hour shift.
But am I right in assuming, though, that layoffs are kind of a mercy move to employees and on the part of the restaurants? Like, at least if you lay people off, they can still collect unemployment if they're not getting their regular paycheck. Is that what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so you're not really firing people, though, right? There's a difference. Is it hard to explain that, though?
It is. It's very hard. I have a lot of individuals who are only, they only speak Spanish. And so trying to explain that to someone who, in their mind, I'm taking them off the schedule, so they're fired. And it's that complete opposite. So definitely a language barrier has been one of my difficult things. But, you know, no, we haven't fired anyone. It's just a temporary layoff. And we really hope that, you know, being able to support at least a few hours a week for each individual here and there, that they'll hang on and support us just as much as we're trying to support them along with this terrible thing that's going on.
We're talking to Erica Oakley. She's the executive chef of Kilroy's downtown Indianapolis and Broad Ripple. Do you speak a little Spanish?
I do. I took many years in high school and college, but I would say I have kitchen Spanish.
Right. Well, that'll do, I guess. So what goes into those kinds of decisions when you have to make those calls, or does that come from above?
A little bit of both. It comes from above of, you know, trying to figure out how do we manipulate this schedule. So we're trying to be fair with everyone. But, you know, unfortunately, I have individuals who come in and roll breadsticks or come in and, you know, do prep work for me or only know certain stations. And, you know, if I'm bringing in people who need to work a full day, then, you know, I need to have them knowing every station. And for instance, if you roll breadsticks for Kilroy's, I don't need a mass amount of breadsticks as I have. So unfortunately, I'm just not able to bring those individuals in.
And it's been a while since I've worked at a restaurant, and none of the ones that I worked at are at the level yours is. So are you just in charge of the kitchen and kitchen personnel, or have you had to lay other people off in other departments as well?
Nope. I just oversee the kitchen at both locations.
And what would you say that those managers who are over those other people, I'm assuming wait staff is at a bare minimum or completely out of the building and maybe they're doing other things. Have those managers had it harder because they've had to lay off more people than you?
I wouldn't say harder. I would say there's just really no opportunity for the front of house. I mean, as you said, we can bring them in for cleaning projects and, you know, making sure that when we do open up, we're raring and ready to go. But, you know, at this point in time, the front of house, I feel like, is a little in more need than, you know, back of house, because I still have projects for the back of house to do with, whether it's deep cleaning or, you know, cleaning out coolers and reorganizing. I mean, I can think of projects to do, but, you know, when there's no guests coming in the front door, servers are kind of at a loss.
You're the executive chef, so your mind has to be on the business of the kitchen. But how upsetting is it for you to give this bad news?
It's absolutely terrible. I've never actually felt the way that I feel in these last few weeks because, you know, I've been that person who's been a line cook and who was hourly. And if at any point in time, my manager would have come to me and said, "Hey, I'm really sorry." You know, a lot of the people who work in food and beverage and in the industry, they don't really know anything else. I mean, they could go find another job. Absolutely. You know, no problem. But their minds are in the bar or serving or in the kitchen. So, you know, it's one of those things. We're not the only ones seeing this, but it's, you know, I have individuals who are coming to me and they're like, they're begging for hours and like, I'll come in and do whatever. So, you know, at this point, we're trying to find projects just to maintain their time and efforts. And it's just, it is, it's really hard. I wake up and try to have a game plan every time I go into work and just kind of how I'm going to approach the day. And definitely know that my positivity has to stay heightened because, you know, if my teammates see me down in the dumps and everything, it just brings them down as well. So I've definitely had to maintain a level of positivity and making sure that I'm reiterating, you know, all the thanks that I have for what they do and continue to work with me, and I'll do the same with them. And, you know, they're very responsive and they understand, but it doesn't make the situation any easier.
And Erica, your scenario, your personal scenario is unique. You've been on the job for how long now?
Almost 3 months.
3 months, just 3 months. And
yeah.
Has that been enough time to even get your feet wet before all this happened?
You know, I was just having a conversation with some of my friends the other night, and I made the comment. I was like, a few weeks ago, I felt that I had my footing. I was like, all right, feeling really good about everything. And then all of this happens. And I'm like, well, wait, I don't know how to do this. This is all new to me. And everyone's like, you're in it with us. We don't know either. We're going to figure it out as a team. So,
I mean, do you you have to dig and find blessings, I guess, wherever you can. Do you kind of take that as a blessing that, again, we're all in this for the first time and
yeah,
you're just
absolutely
as good as anybody else to handle this sort of thing? Is that kind of where your mind's at?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very blessed that I have the support that I do have. A lot of the managers or general managers higher up have been doing this a lot longer. So no systems and implement them a little differently now, but they still know the system and they're able to be like, hey, we've had to, you know, do something like this, you know, a few years ago when we had to shut down, or everything's going to be okay. We're all in this together. We're going to get through it. It's just, we got to keep our heads high and stay positive and know that this will all pass over at some point in time.
So before the order to close all bars and restaurants, what were your days like? What are you doing in a typical day as an executive chef?
Typical day, I choose what store I'm going to be at, start or finish, or I'll bounce around between each store daily. And, you know, I'm doing ordering and receiving, scheduling, inventory, writing recipes, working on new menu layouts, you know, invoicing and things like that. Very, very much admin. I jump on the line every once in a while, you know, when needed, or if we're busy, or I'll jump on Front Expo and get through the rush. But, you know, I'm pretty much overseeing just the basic operations of each kitchen, making sure we've got enough product, making sure I'm talking to my vendors on pricings and making sure I'm getting the best products for what it's worth and things like that.
So what was it like when this order came down from a restaurant perspective? I'm sure there was talk before it kind of all happened that it might happen. Was it a soft blow or was it a big hard blow?
You know, we saw it as a small blow in the beginning because we knew Kilroy's is known for our food and for our beverage, and people love to come and just hang out. So we were definitely gearing for the carry out, and, you know, but after seeing how minimal it has been, it's definitely one of those things. You know, we knew that it could potentially get to where it is now, but it was kind of push to shove when they made the announcement of all bars and restaurants are closed. It, I mean, especially being in the time of where we were with March Madness and, you know, Big Ten and Sweet 16, everyone's geared up for this month. And this is probably the biggest month of the year for our business.
From what I've heard and read, what you're doing there seems pretty typical for a restaurant like yours, one that's been around for a long time and has had a good, steady customer base. But there are some restaurants that have had to close indefinitely, and some of their employees have been let go permanently. Has there been any talk of how much longer this could go on before you have to take the next, possibly more drastic step?
There has been a little bit. We're definitely trying not to look at that aspect because we're definitely trying to be optimistic about the situation. And, you know, we're already talking about when we start up again, when business starts, how much better can we be? What new items and products can we offer? And we're kind of taking this as an opportunity to learn and to be more creative. And, you know, just when we do open, just be ready to go. That is a great question, Matt. I mean, how long is this going to last?
I think a lot of people would agree that what's being done right now is the right thing. This is for our safety, and the consequences otherwise outweigh the consequences that we might see if this were to carry on any longer. But do you have a thought on when you or maybe the people above you would like to see business start up again?
We're definitely we're projecting the 7th, just as the ordinance has said. You know, April 7th is when the next consideration date is for, you know, the startup of bars and food. And that's definitely the date that we're gearing for.
And of course, the president has said as much. The president said that he would like America to be open again by Easter. And there are a number of people who are saying that that's not realistic. I mean, optimism one side and realism on the other. Are you thinking that that is something that your staff is ready for and raring for? Or do you think there's risk in that as well?
You know, I do feel that there's risks because it's very vague on kind of what's going on still. It's one of those things, you know, they say not to go out to restaurants and bars to do carry out, but it's still, you're still surrounding yourself with individuals left and right, and you're trying to make sense of everything. But then at the same time, you know, should we just seclude ourselves for however long and make sure that we don't spread this any more than, you know, physically possible. So it's scary. It's one of those things. It could be 2 weeks. It could be 2 months.
Erica Oakley is the executive chef for two of the biggest independently owned and operated sports pubs in Indianapolis, Kilroy's Downtown and Kilroy's Broad Ripple. Erica, good luck and thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Matt.
Up next, a Ball State economics professor helps us look at the broader economy a bit, one that's, of course, being threatened by this pandemic, and a closer look at one of the symptoms and why, in his view, that symptom gets such a bad rap. We're talking about price gouging. We'll share why he thinks the term is unfair and how it may actually help in some ways. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Have you noticed higher prices than usual on some things? Toilet paper, hand sanitizer, you know, things that everybody wants right now. It may not be the cash grab you think it is. Steve Horwitz is Distinguished Professor of Free Enterprise at Ball State's Miller College of Business, and he joins us now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Matt. Great to be here.
So I said it without saying it. What a lot of people heard was price gouging, right?
Yep. So couple of things. Let me sort of talk about that term, which I think is interesting. First of all, it's important to understand that that term is not an economics term. It has no definition in economics. No economist sort of uses it as a kind of technical term. You know, my sort of glib definition of price gouging is a price that people don't like because it's too high. And there's just no objective definition of how high a price has to be to be an example of gouging. So that's the first point I think that's really important here, is to recognize that this is a kind of political or other term, right? A sort of moral objection to what people are doing. And I prefer to talk about the economics of emergency pricing, because that's what we're really talking about here. What happens during emergencies, natural disasters, pandemics, and how do we understand the way that prices move around during those events?
Well, I guess then, because there are going to be people who say there is such a thing as price gouging, what would be the threshold between emergency pricing and so-called price gouging?
I don't know. I'm not being glib here. I honestly don't know. There's no objective definition of price gouging. States, you know, the state attorney generals and other, you know, the way the laws are written in the 33, 34 states all phrase it very vaguely and differently. And there's a ton of opportunity for attorneys general and other people to enforce it because there's no objective definition of it. But I don't want to get too far into that debate, as important as I think it is, because it misses the real point here. The real point is that allowing prices to rise during an emergency is the most important thing we can do to solve the problem of shortages and low supply. We need to let prices rise to tell the truth, to provide information, right, about how scarce that good is and about the fact that we need more of it. That's what that high price does. I can talk about more specifically the processes, but you know, prices aren't just arbitrary numbers that firms make up. Prices have information attached to them, and they are an incentive. And that combination of information and incentive is what makes it so important to let them tell the truth, even during emergencies.
Well, I know you said you didn't want to get too far into it, but I think it is worth mentioning that yesterday, 33 state attorneys general, as long as we're talking about them, wrote letters to five big online players, Amazon, Walmart, eBay, Facebook, Craigslist, to say they failed to remove unconscionably priced critical supplies. That's a quote. But is that what we're talking about here? Are we talking about the big retailers?
No. Well, that's the interesting thing. For the most part, the big retailers have no reason to sort of jack up their prices this way, because they can always get more of their stuff. Well, I shouldn't say always. It's easier for them to get more stuff, more supplies through their very deep supply networks, right? Walmart, in fact, has an explicit policy that says we won't raise prices during a disaster. They don't need to. They can find it, you know, they can find supplies and so on. It's the smaller businesses who really face the challenge here. A friend of mine told a story about going to his local butcher, and hamburger was about twice the normal price. And I said, I wasn't surprised, right? He's probably having a difficult time finding raw meat, right, from his suppliers in a way that isn't true for, say, Target or Kroger or whatever. And so the only thing he can do with the limited supply he has is to raise that price and say to his customers, look, I've only got a little bit left. If you want to buy some, you got to think carefully about just how badly you want those hamburgers tonight. And you're probably not going to take that hamburger and feed it to the dog either, right? That's the real key here. That high price forces us to make careful decisions. All those pictures of people carting out cases of water is precisely because we don't let the price go up to tell them, hey, you got to make better decisions about how much water you're going to buy. If you know, you're taking out those cases, what are you going to do? Use it again to wash your dog or something? No, right? Right. You got to make, we need the rising price forces people. It provides the information they need and the incentive they need to think really carefully about what they buy. That's one of the two key reasons we need to let prices rise. I can talk about the second as well. The second is that high price acts like a signal flare, like a fireworks that says to other suppliers and other people, hey, look, there's profit to be made here. Look how high this price is. If you bring more supplies of this good in, you have the opportunity to really profit from it. It's more powerful during a natural disaster when things like ice and water can come in from other places. It's a little trickier right now, but even so, there's places around the country that are better stocked than others. And when you let that price rise, you provide the information and the incentive for people from other states or other places to take the risk to bring goods in. And when they bring those goods in, the only way they're going to sell them is charging a price below that high price that signaled them in. And so over time, what we see is that the high price in the short run leads to an increase in supply and falling price over time. One last point. The fact of the matter is these good, like right now, for example, toilet paper is scarce because people are buying it up. You can't change that fact by trying to force the price down. It's scarce. The question is, how do we make it less scarce? And that, I think, you got to let prices do their job and tell the truth about the fact that the good is scarce.
I know that there are going to be some people listening who heard you say, hey, there's profit to be made here, but we're in a tough time, and natural disasters are also a tough time where this sort of thing happens. Is it hard to explain to people that this isn't some sort of a malicious intent kind of a thing?
Well, right. That's a great question, Matt. And I think one of the hardest things in economics is getting people to understand that what matters are the unintended and distant consequences of people's choices, not their intentions. It may be that the guy in the pickup truck who comes in with the cases of water intends to make a ton of profit. It might be that Steve Jobs and Apple, all he cares about is making a ton of profit. But the only way he's going to make that profit is by providing you with something that you want at a price you're willing to pay. So, you know, what profit does here, again, it provides both information and an incentive for people to come in and bring those supplies. And let's be clear about something else. It's not like politicians don't profit from this either. All those attorneys general who are out there bashing on those companies who supposedly haven't, you know, who are pricing too high, they're profiting too by demagoguing this, right? They get votes, they get support, right? Their self-interest is in play too. So this is not like somehow we have these, you know, pure angelic politicians up against the mean old nasty suppliers.
Do you think we'd still have this problem if people weren't panic buying?
Well, so I think it's the other way. I mean, the panic buying, right, is what creates the scarcity, right? So the fact that people are panic buying toilet paper drives up the price of toilet paper and makes it scarce and sort of puts us in this situation, right? I mean, if people had, you know, if that demand, that super high demand weren't there, right? That's essentially what we mean by panic buying. Yeah, we wouldn't see prices rising and we wouldn't have these problems. I mean, it's not, you know, the panic buying isn't always irrational. My wife's been making the point to people that normally I'm the only one home, right, in our house, and now suddenly we have me and my wife and two kids home 24/7. We need more toilet paper, right? It's not panic buying to sort of buy more toilet paper. So again, these things are complicated. But I want to stress one point again, which is it's the most important thing to help people understand about how economists think and why economics is important is understanding that idea of unintended consequences. The guys coming in to make profit, yeah, their goal might be to profit, but the unintended consequence of that is that they're bringing in those supplies, they're driving the price down, and they're getting us back to some semblance of normalcy.
So I guess what we're saying is that morally we're talking about riding the line between immoral, the guy on Craigslist selling bottles of hand sanitizer for $30, and say, I don't know, reasonably considerate versus immoral, the person with the convenience store who raises the price because they want to keep their stock.
Well, right. But even the guy selling for $30, right? I mean, is anyone going to buy it? And if they do, what's the problem? Right. They really needed the hand sanitizer. They're willing to pay $30 for it. I think my students do this all the time. They want to make this separation between the economic and the moral. But it seems to me there's nothing more moral in a crisis than finding ways to bring new supplies of the good to the marketplace and driving down the price in the process. These guys who risk, you know, take the risk, and one of the risks they take is the attorney general coming down on them, take the risk of bringing in new supplies. Are they going to be able to sell it? Can, you know, have to pay for the gas and everything else? Those guys, I think, are acting quite morally, right? They're helping solve this problem. Even if you don't like the price they charge, again, charging the high price is because the good is scarce. You can't change that. Your choice is between places that have high prices and a supply of the good, and places that have low prices and no supply of the good. That's the choice we face. And there's no way around that choice, given the fact that the good is so scarce.
We're talking with distinguished professor of free enterprise at Ball State's Miller College of Business, Steve Horwitz, about some of the so-called price gouging that is happening. But it's not a term it sounds like you like very much. What about the people, and there are plenty, who would be able to afford these basics under normal circumstances, but they go to their local store and it's more than they can pay? It seems like either situation is bad for them. If the price is low, stores get bought out and then there's nothing there. But if the price is high, there might be product, but it's too expensive.
Yeah. So a couple of things there, right? I mean, at one level, putting price controls on and charging firms with price gouging isn't going to solve that problem, right? I mean, that's just a real problem coming from the scarcity. I do think, though, that again, depending on where you are and what the nature of the crisis is, there's almost always someone selling that good at a different price, right? At a lower price. It may be that during a crisis, during an emergency, we have to spend a little more what economists would call search costs, right? That we have to be, you know, sort of smarter shoppers and invest a little more time in it. But it's not going to be the case that everyone's selling bottled water for $30 a case. Somebody might be, but someone else is likely not to, especially, again, when we think about the big stores who, again, Walmart and others have said, we're not going to raise prices during these kind of crises. So I think there's options available. I don't want to sound unsympathetic, but the reality is it is a crisis, and we can't wave a magic wand and make that scarcity go away. The way to make it go away is to deal with the short run pain as those prices rise and signal and encourage people to bring more supplies in. If you put price controls on, the pain is going to last for a much longer time. So it's a choice between two imperfect alternatives. And I wish there was a magic wand, but there's not. And I think we just have to get through it in the short run.
I want to, since I have you and you're an economist, I want to get as close to that magic wand, theoretical magic wand, as we can. It seems like you, economists, have to really think outside the box to propose solutions to problems like this. And some of the, sometimes those solutions aren't something that a lot of people understand. Exactly. Could there be a more complex solution to a problem like this that we could unpack in a few minutes during a radio interview?
I don't think there is. I think it's that simple. I mean, this is what we teach, this stuff in Econ 101, right? This role of prices and the problem of price controls. This is basic econ stuff. It really is that simple. People, there's a lot of reasons people resist this reasoning, and a lot of it, you know, some of it has to do with just deep in our sort of primal brains. We just don't. It bothers us, and we find it offensive that people would treat other people that way, because we're used to, you know, we live so long in these very tight knit groups, and it feels like we're harming a member of our family, and so there's sort of these deep moral reactions that people have. And the hard part as an economist is sort of getting over that, right, and helping people to understand, I know it feels wrong, and I know your reaction is disgust, but the reality is, if you want to solve this problem, this is what you need to do. And by the way, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, making this argument to this audience, I'm going to have to shut down my email for a few days, I suspect. I did this on CNN a couple of years ago, and boy, you should have seen some of the email I got. So,
oh boy.
So we'll see. It's okay. I'm not, this is my job. And I think, you know, speaking the truth in these situations and trying to make sure we understand, we have a problem to solve. How do we solve it? This from an economist's perspective is the best way to solve it.
Well, while I have you, let's talk about the broader economy. A lot of people are hurting. Yeah. Congress just passed a $2 trillion with a T dollar coronavirus relief bill. From your perspective as an economist, is that the right move?
I think two things. I think it is important in this crisis to try to ensure that small businesses make their way through it. And so I think any kind of package that involves loans for small businesses is probably a good thing. I'm a little concerned about the sort of other side of this. I think we need to help people who are unemployed. I think we need to do it in reasonable ways that help them, but still are fiscally responsible. And importantly, don't discourage them from looking for work when this is all over, right? I've looked at some of the details. The payout to workers is generous, and I'm glad that we're doing something to help. I just worry sometimes that if we do too much, we end up prolonging unemployment in ways that we don't want to. But I actually think more important is the idea of lending to small businesses to help get them through this. I don't like them being turned into grants. What I would prefer is we keep interest rates really low, if not zero even, and let firms pay those back when the crisis is passed.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was quick to say, though, that this is not a stimulus package. It's emergency relief. What's the difference in your view?
Stimulus is when we are, you know, in a recession, right? And the belief is that if we spend money, we'll get ourselves out of a recession. We're not in a recession right now. This is not macroeconomic stimulus. It's more like a form of insurance almost. McConnell's right. He's not right very often, but he's right about that distinction. And I wish the media would stop using the word stimulus. It's not about whether the idea is good or not. It's about that word. It's not a stimulus package, right? It's help. It's help for the unemployed. It's help for small businesses.
I think what a lot of people don't fully understand is where this enormous amount of money is coming from. A trillion is 1,000 billion. It's almost incomprehensible. Right. There are fewer stars in our own galaxy. We're about to pump two of those into the economy. How?
Good question, right? I mean, the key up to all of this is the Federal Reserve, one, and the willingness of Congress to continue borrowing and run up the deficit. So I mean, you know, Congress can spend, right? It just has to be the case that someone's willing to buy up the bonds that are, you know, someone's willing to lend money basically to the federal government to make that happen. And that can be the private sector buying bonds. It can be the Fed buying up bonds and engaging in expansionary monetary policy. So the answer in some sense is that we can create it out of nowhere to some degree. That's what the Fed does. And if people are willing to lend government money to support these things by buying up bonds and other kinds of financial instruments, then okay.
Steve Horwitz is Distinguished Professor of Free Enterprise at Ball State University's Miller College of Business. Stay safe, Steve.
Thank you, sir. You too.
And that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Maybe use some of that free time to catch up on the podcast. We're back on Monday at this time. Until then, wash your hands, keep your distance, and hang in there. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.